Before we start, I mean, I have a corrections to make to the tutorial, and thanks to Benjamin for pointing this out. There was a technical error in the tutorial. So the kernel K that we were talking about, it is actually a normal subgroup. So we don't, when we prove the isomorphism theorem, we don't have to assume that K is a normal subgroup. And you can show that easily, that K is a normal subgroup, and I have corrected it and added it to the existing tutorial. And for those who are just auditing the class, I will email the solution, okay? So this is actually, the kernel was, you know, is a normal subgroup. Okay, so today we are going to talk about representations. And we start with a matrix group. So you've already seen, you know, matrix groups such as SO3, and as well as, you know, you've seen SO3, right? You've seen O3, and you've seen SO1,3 and O1,3. So this is the Lorentz group, and this is the connected component of the Lorentz group, meaning those connected to the identity. This is the three-dimensional orthogonal group, and these are the rotations. However, to define representation in general, we need another matrix group, which is GLNC. So this is, you know, the group of n by n matrices with complex entries. And non-zero determinant. So as usual, this means that the identity matrix is the identity element. Because the matrices have non-zero determinant, that means they're invertible. So the inverse element is the inverse of the matrix is the inverse element of the group. And and because of the nice property of determinant is that, so if I have matrix M1, M2, and that's, sorry, so this is, say, equal to M3. Now if I take the determinant of this equation, then I can determine M1, M2 is determinant M3. And because the property, nice property of determinants that it nicely factorizes means that if M1 and M2, the determinant of M1 and determinant of M2 are non-zero, so is the determinant of M3. So, you know, so it does close under multiplication. And so this is a nice group, and there's a more general that we will need. And the dimension of GLNC is 2n squared dimensional, because the condition that the determinant of M is not equal to 1 does not actually, is not restrictive enough to eliminate any of the 2n squared parameters needed to specify a matrix, yes.
Let me define like the M1, M2, are those in this new group?
Yeah, we are saying that, yeah, exactly. So, you know, if M1 for, so, okay, what I'm doing is that I'm saying, okay, I take an M1 and M2 whose determinant is not zero, and I multiply them, and ask if the product has determinant zero or not. And we can see that, of course, if these guys don't have determinant zero, this also has determinant non-zero, right? So that means that M3 is in the group. So I'm just showing that how the multiplication is actually, it closes. Okay, so this is essentially closure. Yes.
I think I did not realize that the determinant is actually a homomorphism from matrices to R without the zero, and like the product has multiplication.
Sorry?
I did not realize that the determinant is a homomorphism, actually.
Of course it is, yeah. Oh, what is the sound? Sorry, I'm going to take this off. This is very annoying. Yeah?
Sorry. Do you mean in the last condition that the matrices are inverted, right? Zero.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. This means that M are invertible. Yeah.
No, she means that at the right you wrote determinants of M different from one at the right and zero.
Oh yeah, sorry. Yeah, good. Thank you. All right. So what's the representation? Have you seen the painting by this Belgian painter, which is René Magritte? It's like it's a painting of a pipe, and it's a this is not a pipe. So,
oh, yeah.
So that's a representation of a pipe, not a pipe. So. So a representation of a group, or of the group G, is defined as the homomorphism also called a map. So it's D and it's a map from G to GL and C, you know, such that the group structure is preserved. Obviously, the identity element is given by the identity matrix, and the inverse element maps onto the inverse matrix. Okay.
Do we have to assume that G is finite?
No.
No.
No, G doesn't have to be a finite group.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then for the underlying, you're just choosing the underlying vector space to be C just for physical reason, Cn.
Right.
Restriction to that.
It'll be a restriction to that, yes. Yeah. It'll depend on the group, but that's, yeah, it'll depend on which group, because that's actually a very important thing to keep in mind. But yeah, it'll be Whereas this homomorphism might be into some, you know, some subset of GLN and C, right? And the way you restrict that will be reflected by the vector space it acts on. Yeah. Right. Here it goes. So some examples. So we have already seen examples of, say, SO3 and SO1,3. And these guys are in, say, GL3C. And you know these guys are in, say, GL4C. And so the way we encountered these two groups was, you know, we defined them in terms of matrices, right? So SO3 was defined, you know, by, say, O transpose O equals to 1 and determinant of O1 with, say, OA 3x3, you know, real matrix, right? So such matrix, you know, definitions, such, you know, matrix representation is known as the defining representation. Okay, so there's a defining representation. And we will see, for the matrix groups, we will see a lot of these examples. So let me give you a matrix, an example of the dihedral group.
Dirac.
Yeah.
But in the definition, it is supposed to be a complex number, and then you have real matrices.
Yeah, it's a homomorphism, so it doesn't have to be, it can be a restriction of the complex numbers.
Oh, okay.
Right? And yeah, but, and depending on, you know, what you're working for, you know, because here this was acting on some real vector space, so if you allow this to complex, it would take us out of that real vector space, right? So the dihedral group say D4 was the group of a square without any without directed sides. So okay, let me just put on some axes. So this is, say, the x-axis and the y-axis. And what are the transformation of the square that keeps it? It's a symmetry transformation. There's of course the do nothing. And now what we're doing is that we are representing them in terms of 2x2 matrices. So that is do nothing. And then there is the rotation by 90 degrees. And this is given by this. And then there are squared and then are cubed. So one comment about R squared looks like the minus identity. Of course, as matrix, R squared is minus identity, but there is no such thing as minus the identity element. Okay, from a group theoretic point of view, there's no such thing as, so don't think of this as somehow minus, you know, the identity. And then there are the reflections. So there's a reflection around the x-axis. And this is given by this thing. and reflection around the y-axis. In addition, we also have the diagonals. We also have, I think, sorry, this does, and this is D2. And you can also reflect around them, about them. And so, and this, I think this is D1, yeah, given by D1 and D2. Right. So this is a matrix representation of the dihedral group. So another important comment is that representations can be faithful or unfaithful. Right. So what is it? So representation is often shortened as rep. Right, okay. So the short version of this is that the representation is faithful if D is an isomorphism. So what I mean is that, of course, you know, the representation D, you know, maps from the group G to GLNC, but you can restrict it to the image within GLNC, right? And once you've done that, if the map is an isomorphism, then it's a faithful representation. So in other words, if D is a representation of G that maps distinct elements of G to, say, distinct elements of the set D of G. This is what I mean. So basically, D of G is consists of all D of G for, right. Then we say the representation is faithful. So otherwise, the representation is called an unfaithful representation. So there's one of the representations, say, for any of these groups is the trivial representation. So where you basically map the whole group to the number one, for example. That's an example of a trivial representation. And of course, that is not a faithful representation. Right? This is not an isomorphism. Okay? So, yeah. All right? So, because we are dealing with matrices, you know from physics that, you know, if we say change a reference frame, a rotation matrix changes by similarity transformation, right? And you know, similarity transformations in physics mean that if two matrices are related by similarity transformation, in physics, you know, we essentially treat them as equal, right? Equivalent, say they are. They are reflecting different, you know, reference frames. So that motivates the definition of equivalent representations. So two representations, say D and D prime of the group G are said to be equivalent if D prime of G is S of D times G of G, S inverse, for all G. So note that the matrix S is independent of G. So, so the idea behind equivalent representation is that they are being expressed in different bases. So we think, not thing, think of D of G and D prime of G being the same but same something, but indifferent. Okay. Bases.
Would this be the case, like if you have a quantum system for spin half particle measuring the x or y direction? Like if you have your matrix in the x direction and you're just changing the base, you just your Dagger, that would be
exactly. Yeah, exactly.
It's just the same measurement, but you're just using different.
Exactly. Bases. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's exactly it. Yeah, that's a very good example. So let's give a. Oh God, what happened here? Oh yeah. So let's give an example of. Okay. So let's take C3. So, you know, as we saw that C3 is essentially if you have a triangle with directed sides, you know, if you have a triangle with directed sides, like an equilateral triangle, right? C3 is the symmetry group of that group. So essentially what you're doing is that you're rotating, the generator of C3 is just a rotation by 120 degrees. So, So this is a representation of C3. And I think it's simple, but you know, it's quite instructive. So this is actually an embedding of C3 in SO3. So for example, what we can say is that we can take some vector, position vector in R3, okay? And then rotate that position vector around the z-axis by 120 degrees, right? And that will form the group C3. So that's what we are doing here. So if you do that, then the matrices are and this is a discrete subgroup of SO3. That's how we have written it, but so half 2 minus square root of 3/2 half 0, 0, 0, 1. Now note that these matrices have the form that there's a 2/2 block and there's one. And so this 2/2 block and this guy don't really interact, right? And what and physically what you're saying is that the z component of the position vector is not really changing under rotation. So this motivates the following. So in some sense, it's a representation which is reducible to smaller representation. So reducibility of representation. So a representation, say, of dimension n plus m is said to be reducible if, okay, representation D, if D of G takes the form D of G is equal to, say, A of G, C of G, 0, this block diagonal form for all G in big G, you know, where A, C, and B are n by m and m by m matrices, respectively. Okay. So now, interesting to note that if I have, say, you know, say, if I do the group multiplication, say D of G1 of D of G2, then it'll have the form of, say, A of G1, A of G2, and this will be 0, and this here we'll have B of G1 and B of G2. But here there'll be some mixture of A, B, and C, right, in general. Or So if I just look at this bit, it looks like the group. If I look at this bit, it looks like the group, but this bit doesn't. Okay. Now for finite groups, and compact groups, we will come to the idea of compactness at some point more formally. But for compact group, basically essentially means that if your parameter space is a compact manifold, so for example, intuitively, you know, rotations are compact because, you know, if you do, if you keep on doing rotations, you come back to the same point. But Lorentz boost, you can just keep on doing Lorentz boosts and your object just keeps on increasing in its velocity, right? So the Lorentz boost parameter actually takes value in, you know, if you express it in the correct way on the real line. So it's non-compact.
How did we reduce that matrix? Like, how did you see that there is some reducibility there?
There is actually a theorem. It's some linear algebra, you know, a couple of pages of linear algebra. It's called, I think, Mashke's theorem or something like this. But yeah, you can just, you know, do some linear algebra.
You can reduce this composition.
Yeah, you can basically reduce that to block diagonal form. Right. So for finite and compact group, if you can find, right, can find, you know, can find bases such that C is zero, okay? And if this is the case, then it's called completely reducible. Now, you might say, okay, before I make the very interesting comment, is that, so another comment is that for finite and abelian groups, the complex and unitary representations . So unitary means U is unitary if its dagger is equal to its inverse. Sorry, I should, this should be inserted here. So for finite abelian groups, the complex and unitary representations are one-dimensional. So for example, if I take C3. So here we had a 2x2 representation, but recall that the 2x2 representation was necessarily real. It could not be complex because we were acting on some vector space where, you know, we were working with a real positive vector. So, but if you take C3, then it's non-trivial, you know, complex okay. I just realized I haven't told you what irreducibility is. And it's kind of implied, but it's important to point out. And the idea is that, sorry, I'll come back to that. If a representation is not reducible, meaning that no, yeah, that there are. You know, that the matrices cannot be brought to this form by doing any similarity transformation, then we say, then the representation is an irreducible representation, also known as an EREP, irreparably. EREP. Okay. Okay. So, sorry, coming back to this now. So the comment is, for finite abelian groups, the complex and this will actually follow from a theorem that we will state in a minute. So if you take C3, you know the multiplication table of these phase factors is of course the same as C3, right? So this is essentially, as you know, you're just rotating the vector on the complex plane by 120 degrees, right? So, but these two representations, you know, there is no way to, you know, bring one to the other by a similarity transformation by multiplying on two sides with the same complex number. So they are inequivalent representations. So these are say. Inequivalent reps. They're also EREPs. Another irreducible representation, as well as inequivalent, is this. Okay, so these are all, but this is a trivial representation. And it turns out, for C3, these are the only irreducible representation. And it arises from a consideration of characters, which we won't get into. But I will tell you what, you know, when we come to a discussion of the characters, I will tell you how this arises. All right. Yes.
You can have similar elements in the representation.
Yes, because and that's why it's a exactly. That's why it's not a faithful representation. So for example, you know, one is mapped to one, this is mapped to one, this is mapped to one. So this is not an isomorphism. So it's an unfaithful representation. So this is unfaithful. And these are, of course, the faithful representations. Okay, so these are faithful. Okay, you don't seem convinced. So if I go back, you know, how many elements does C3 have? It has three elements, right? The identity, rotation by 120 degrees, rotation by 240, right? So this is, if I take a complex number now, say, on the complex plane, which is then multiplying this one means that I'm not changing it. Multiplying by this means that I am rotating it by 120 degrees, right? Is that 120? No, that's less than 100. Anyway, yeah, something like this, right? And multiplying it by this again will take me back to the original. And this is multiplying twice this amount. And these guys are multiplying this vector, but rotating it in the counterclockwise direction, right?
Keeper?
Yeah?
But like, isn't rotating by rotating 120 degree clockwise the same as rotating 240 degrees anti-clockwise? So why can't?
Yeah, yeah, of course they are.
So why aren't they equivalent then?
They are not equivalent because of the formal definition that you can't really find a similarity transformation to connect them. And complex conjugation in general, in at least in group theory, you will see the example of this, is that many representations have their complex conjugate representation. And in general, you cannot relate them. So here it's abelian, but in general, you cannot really relate them by similarity transformation. And here you can't. I mean, you can try. You cannot find. Yes.
If we were looking at this in R2, which is a two-dimensional real vector space, then we would be able to make a change of basis to relate the two sorts of rotations. But we're looking at it in the complex numbers.
Yeah, exactly.
Change of basis here is essentially changing one by another complex number with, for example, minus one or I or something like this. And we cannot map one into the other by doing so.
Yeah, you can't. Yeah. Yeah.
So I'd like to ask you about the one-dimensional. What does it mean when you say that the unitary representations are one-dimensional?
Meaning that they're one-by-one matrices.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So that's, yeah, I should have probably, yeah. So the dimensionality, that's a very good question. So dimensionality of a rep D is the, say, the dimensionality of the matrices, matrices D, okay? So this is not a very elegant definition, but that's basically what I mean. Yes?
Why do we have unfaithful representations?
Because the world is not perfect. I guess it's a mathematical fact, but you know, it's actually quite profound as well.
Okay.
I mean, you can think, well, I think sometimes of group homomorphisms, which are not isomorphisms, as unfaithful representations.
Mm-hmm.
And that allows for all kinds of interesting physics to appear, right? So for example, you know, you have rotations, you know, if rotations of vectors and rotation of spinners are different, although they're both rotations, you know. You know, if you rotate a spinner by 360 degrees, it doesn't come back to itself, whereas a rotation of a vector does. And so I think, so a more better answer to your question would be that I think unfaithful representation allow us to have different species of particles.
Also in information theory, faithfulness of purifications and unfaithfulness has to do with the fact of whether a state is pure or not, which is nice.
Sorry, can you repeat that?
That in information theory, when you purify some density matrix,
right,
if at the end you get the representation of your original algebra, which is faithful, that means that your density matrix was really not pure, and yet has to do with that purity of the density.
Okay, so I won't get drawn into a discussion about density matrices and whether they represent real states or because, you know, at PI at least, that's like
a problem.
Yeah, that's a minefield. You know, no two people will have the same opinion about that. All right. Yeah.
Is there a connection between irreducibility and symmetry in your system? Because here you said there was a symmetry around the z-axis, and then the representation happened to be reducible.
Yeah,
mechanics for like hydrogen atom. With the Coulomb potential, there's a rotation symmetry and the representation of the rotation of the angular momentum is not irreducible. It's irreducible.
No, I think you have there is something in that intuition, but I think reducibility is related to whether, you know, part of your, whether the action of the group is acting non-trivially on some part of your system. And here, you know, our system is just a vector and the Z component is being acted on trivially almost. But I haven't thought about it carefully enough to be able to generalize this into a theorem. And, but in quantum mechanics, you know, the irreducible representation of the rotation group, you know, the degeneracy and stuff, which I will talk about, you know, it assumes that the group is acting non-trivially on all the vectors there, right? which is not the case here.
Well,
yes.
On this sentence here, on this word, there is an irreducible meaning, right? For finite abelian group,
yeah,
the complex irreducible and unitary representations are one-dimensional, right?
For that.
Yeah,
right. The complex and unitary irreducible representations are one-dimensional. Yeah, exactly. Thank you very much. Yeah. Yes?
So does order matter in representations? Because if you took that second one...
No, it's a set, so it doesn't.
But if you, like... If you reverse the ordering and then multiply by phase of like e to the I.
Well, but multiplication by phase is not a similarity transformation.
It's not.
No, because you have to multiply S and S inverse. So it's, you know, so. Because, right? I mean, so of course these two, so if you multiply by, so if omega, you know, if you multiply by alpha and you know, alpha inverse in this case, you know, it's abelian, so it's going to just not do anything. But yeah, good. However, you're onto something. And you're onto something because in physics, when we are discussing Hilbert spaces, we actually only care about vectors in Hilbert space up to some overall phase factor. So if the, you know, so if two rep, so basically in, you know, I'll just mention it, but, you know, Weinberg's book on quantum theory fields, volume one has more about it, is that in physics, you know, we consider a different class of representation in quantum mechanics, which are known as projective representation, you know, where essentially what will happen is that if you have, you know, representations don't have to be equal to this, but there could be a phase which depends on G1 and G2. And those are also allowed in quantum mechanics. All right, so perhaps the most important result in representation theory is Schur's lemma. There are two Schur's lemma. One is the easy one, which I will tell you, and there's a more complicated one, which I won't. So by the way, you know, the guy who really established quantum mechanics, the group theory in quantum mechanics, was Wigner. And I think Wigner had done his PhD, and he got a faculty, he got a job after his PhD as working for his dad's in a workshop, but he really wanted to do physics. So he went and talked to some guy who was working and he says, oh, you know, I think he wanted to work on quantum mechanics and symmetry. And the guy said, okay, he gave him a problem about classification of the crystallographic groups, I think. And he says, oh, by the way, you'll need this book by Schur, you know, he's famous for this, so it won't be easy. So basically, Wigner's career was launched because he understood Schur's work. So Schur's lemma, that's our next. The book by Z has more detailed description of this anecdote. So I won't prove this, but the proof is there in various textbooks. So if D is an irreducible representation, say of a group G, and B is a matrix such that B commutes with all those D of G, then B is proportional to the identity matrix. Okay? Very simple. Of course, I mean, if you have played with matrices, you know it makes sense, because if you have a large group of matrices, it's hard to find a matrix that'll commute with all of them. But this just formalizes it. Okay, maybe I should write it in words, or i.e. B is proportional to the identity matrix. Okay. And in physics, the eigenvalue, the constant lambda often has some physical interpretation. So for example, it'll be, you know, we will see application of this angular momentum, where this would be the total angular momentum. And B would be the square, J squared, square of the of the angular momentum operator. We'll come to that. Okay. It's fitting that after faithfulness, discussion of faithfulness and unfaithfulness, we should discuss characters. And so characters are a convenient way of distinguishing different representations. So this is actually not, this is actually quite useful, because suppose I give you like a set of matrices, and I tell you, well, I give you two set of matrices, right? And I tell you, are they equivalent? What are you going to do? You say, okay, let me punch in all those matrices into Mathematica, and then maybe take one random matrix from one set, another random matrix from another set, see if I can find a similarity transformation between them, and see if that similarity transformation works for all the others. Essentially, it'll be a mess in general. You know, for simple cases, it might not be, but it could be. So you want to have some invariant way of distinguishing different representations. And characters provide you a way of doing that. So what's a character reference? I'm sorry, not a reference, but so the character of a representation D of group G is a set. So chi, which consists of all of chi g, where chi of g is the trace of the representation matrix D of G. So what is chi of G? Chi of G is the trace of D of G. Okay, so this is, how does this work? Let's explain that in the comments. So you all know the cyclicity of the trace formula. This is easy to prove. If you haven't done it, do it. And CAB can be written, right? So BCA, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So using this as cyclicity, we can see that, okay, if I take some matrix from a particular representation, and suppose this matrix is related to an equivalent representation, so DG is related to S, so I'm assuming D of G is S D prime of G, S inverse for all G. But then I use the cyclicity of trace, and then S inverse cancels out. So if two representations are equivalent, their characters are equivalent. So this is, the left-hand side is chi of G, and the same over here. Another useful observation is that character is a function of conjugacy class. Oh, shit. Are you okay? Yeah.
Does the implication go both ways? It's supposed
to. Yeah, it does, and that's a theorem. Yeah. I'll quote that theorem, yeah. There's the character orthogonality theorem. It's a very famous theorem. And it actually comes from, there's an orthogonality theorem for representations, which is extremely powerful. It has so much information that if you just take a trace of it, you get the character orthogonality theorem. So I won't prove it, but it's done in Jones and a bunch of other books. And yeah, exactly. That's a very good point. The thing is that it goes both ways. So, of course, if two, we haven't. Okay, let me just take it one step at a time. Okay. Where's my chalk? There you are. All right. So comment number two is that character is a function of conjugacy class. of course, physicists love bad puns. So Z's book has a whole chapter whose title is Character is a Function of Class. Sorry, that has to be said in an American accent. Otherwise, it doesn't work. And of course, remember that a conjugacy class is defined up to a conjugation of elements. So G1 is in the same conjugacy class as G2 if there exists a G such that G1 is related to G2 like that, right? So that means that, you know, chi of G1, because we have to take trace of both sides, you know, so this is trace of G of G2 and G inverse, but using the cyclicity of the trace, G and G inverse drops out. So we get this is G2, so chi of G2. So an extremely important theorem is suppose that we have chi M, basically these are the, say, character of, so by character, so okay, a slight abuse of language, we will use the word character for both the collection as well as the individual, you know, elements of the character set, okay? So this is the characters of A rep, which I'm labeling by mu, and then it follows that if you sum over all the group elements, so this is not a power, so let's call it. So where this is the order of the group. So it means that if you have two different characters, they're orthogonal when you sum over the whole group. And so this basically means that you can use characters if of course you have two different sets of characters, they're different representations. But if the characters, if you compute the characters of different representation, then they'll be different as well. So it goes both ways. Okay, so right. Now, characters, of course, are like equivalence classes, conjugacy classes, you know, divide your groups into equivalence classes, right? So if you have, say, small ki elements in the conjugacy class say big ki, then this thing becomes so now the sum is only over the conjugacy classes. This is the number of conjugacy elements in your conjugacy class. Then you have some representative element. And okay. So these formulae have their generalization for continuous groups if the continuous group is compact, okay? And we will when I come to SU2, I will, you know, I will basically give you the formula for the character, for you know, the analogous formula for SU2.
Okay.
So let's just write that down. So has generalizations. For compact continuous groups. Yeah.
The J index is all right.
Sorry?
The J index?
The J, oh, so there's no J, there's all I. Sorry. This is I. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Sorry.
I thought that it was a G.
Yeah. No. Sorry. My handwriting is wobbly at the best of times. So, some important comments, further observations, is that so this is a very important comment about characters. Sorry, I can't go into the detailed theory of characters. It's actually quite beautiful, and I think some of the people who developed group theory, like Cayley, they actually used characters to essentially develop a lot of the representation theory. So it's a very deep subject with a lot of pedigree, and I encourage you to look into it, but you know, I can't really go too much deep into it. But I want to give you, you know, one or two important, fact about characters is that, so for finite groups, so the number of inequivalent irreducible representations, say R, is equal to the number of conjugacy classes. The total number of conjugacy classes, let's call it K. Okay. So R is equals to K. So we can now write down what is the character table. Of C3, so basically this is a table where along the rows you write down the irreducible representations. Oops. And the columns are the conjugacy classes. Now for abelian groups, every element is its own conjugacy class, right? For abelian group, every element is its own conjugacy class. So that's why C3 has three elements, therefore three conjugacy classes. If I had time, you know, we would like, and you can look up example of character tables for more complicated groups like the D4. There, the number of, you know, columns will not be equal to the number of group elements, okay? And this is the character. Of course, for abelian case, tracing doesn't have any meaning. So tracing a matrix is just the matrix then a number is just the number itself. So you can, okay, where omega is so that's a character table. So I won't have anything more to say about characters. The discussion in Jones's book is actually quite nice, I think. And you know, Z also has a lot of discussion on it. So you know, look into that. There's a lot more information about characters that allows you to you know really build up this character tables from scratch. So. I now want to, before I move on to Lie algebras and Lie groups, I want to take a brief detour and discuss, you know, why some of the applications of these ideas in quantum mechanics. Just some very basic applications. Because let's not forget, you know, we are doing this for physics. So, okay, so this is basically wraps up the formal part of representation theory. And now I want to discuss a little bit about, you know, application of representation theory in quantum mechanics. And then tomorrow we will talk about Lie groups and Lie algebras. So I'm sorry it took a while to get there, but it's actually very necessary to build up these machineries first. All right. So representation theory and quantum mechanics. Okay, so this is, quantum mechanics is important for, representations are important for quantum mechanics, and there's a very famous theorem by Wigner. From the early 1930s, when Europe was the center of quantum mechanics. And it goes something like this. The group of symmetries of a quantum mechanical system is represented by linear unitary or anti-unitary. So by anti-unitary, I mean there means linear, but unitary and I think it's unitary plus antilinear. Operators so acting on a Hilbert space. And I think this, the fact this is theorem, we don't even think about it. The way quantum mechanics is taught, you know, this is almost like, you know, shown as, you know, as an axiom. So I won't do the proof in detail, but look at Weinberg. So Weinberg, Quantum Theory of Fields, Volume 1. You know, it has a more detailed proof of this, if you can get through his notation. All right, so what is the outline of our, I'll give a very brief outline of our proof. It's very intuitive. So suppose we have two states, psi 1, psi 2, and they live in my Hilbert space H, which represents the physical states of the quantum system. And the observables have this form, right? It's either probabilities or transition matrix and things like that, you know? Whatever, observe, everything that we can say about a quantum system is more or less, you know, built out of these guys. So under some symmetry transformation, so, say, so we have under, you know, some symmetry transformation. And it could be, for example, rotations or translations, which may or may not be the symmetry of your theory, but let's assume one of these guys is. Then, you know, in general, it'll change by some, you know, some operator. No. So the symmetry transformation, say, is represented, is given by some G within big G. Okay. So now, because it's a symmetry, you know, the physical amplitudes will remain unchanged. So that means this statement. Right? The probabilities will remain unchanged, because that's what we measure at the end of the day. So this equation has two solutions. One is this, sorry, I'm going to drop the G dependence for now. So this is one. So in that case, U dagger is equal to U inverse, i.e., well, okay. So in that case, we say U is unitary, but it's also possible that I think there's a Yeah. I think there's a typo in my notes. I wrote psi 2. Ah, okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's correct, yeah. So in that case, U is called anti-unitary. And there's also a group structure. And suppose we have, say, three observers. So we have three observers. And so who are related by symmetry transformations. So if observer one is looking at the system at the state psi one, observer two is given by, so okay, observer one is taken to observer two's reference frame by say G1, and then observer two is taken to observer three's by G2. So that means that there'll be some matrix which will depend on say, sorry, this should be G1. And so observer two observes this, and then there'll be another matrix which depends on G2, which will take psi prime to psi double prime. But there should be a transformation symmetry from taking observer one to observer three. Okay, before we go there, you know, we can rewrite this as psi double prime is U of G2, U of G1 of psi prime. But I will just switch. I can go to the other side. Right. Of course, psi so because observer one and three are related by G3, did I write that? No, I didn't. Okay, let's do that. So so this means that U of G3 is given by U of G2 and U of G1. So there's a group structure multiplication. Of course, and this is the outline of the proof. Well, the comment is that in quantum mechanics, we are allowed a slightly more general representation. And such representations are called projective representations. The second comment that I want to make is, so for example, time reversal operator in quantum mechanics is an anti-unitary operator. So time reverse, so you know, when we look at the quantum world, you know, and we see particles interacting, well, we don't really see the particles, quantum particles, what we see. We have like diagrams, we have processes which, well, you know what I mean. So suppose now I turn the film backward. A lot of times, you know, in a lot of processes, it's not really possible to tell the backward from the forward process. So a lot of theories in quantum field theories are actually time reversible. But there are parts of our data which is not time reversible. So the time reversibility is actually, it does not have to be a symmetry. but if it is, then you know what it means is that the time reversal there exists a time reversal operator which commutes with the Hamiltonian, but the evolution of a state is given by something by the Hamiltonian. By the time evolution operator. Now, if I apply the time in the time reversal operator, so let's call it t hat, on my state, then I have it reverses the time in the argument. But of course, this guy is given by t. E to the power minus I h of t. And here I can insert the time reversal operator and its inverse. So you know, we expect that that this should be given by e to the power I h t. Right? If I, wait, just from this formula, if I just, you know, replace t by minus t, this should give me this. So this operation should also give me that. So, but here, you know, what I have is that t e minus h hat of t inverse, this has argument zero, so this guy doesn't change. Now,
I think the insert should be t minus t instead of t minus.
Thank you. Yeah. So right, but if I just now use this equation, then what I get is, if I were to use say star only. You know, only star only gives t, say, minus I h t inverse. This will only give me, right? Because it's just commuting with h. It's not doing anything else. This is not what we expect. So we have to also say that it acts on the imaginary by conjugation. And if you do that, then this will give me e to the power plus I ht psi of 0. You might say, oh, why isn't the t flipping the signs of the time t? Well, the time t is here just a parameter. You know, it's a passive object. You know, you cannot have any quantum operator acting on it, right? So it's only when, so this means that the operator T is actually not a linear operator, it's an antilinear operator. So, you know, so basically an operator O is antilinear if O acting on, say, alpha psi 1 plus beta psi 2 gives you alpha star O psi 1 plus beta star O psi 2. This is an antilinear operator. Okay? So, and if it's unitary and antilinear, then unitary meaning it preserves the modulus of the, you know, well, it's a little bit of a technical thing because, you know, unitary operator actually, transformations preserve the inner product, whereas anti-unitary don't, they only preserve the mod of the inner product. So, you know, as we saw here. But it's also linear. Okay, I think I'll stop there. But next time we will talk about Lie groups, yay.